You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Peely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Telemark Ski Resort in Cable, Wisconsin, once brought in thousands of visitors from around the world, but this year, it's being torn down. We'll learn about its history and how cross-country skiing could still figure into its future. Now, as schools around the country work to address race and inequality in the U.S., conservatives are sounding the alarm over a particular teaching being used. It's called critical race theory. It was developed by leading legal theorists a few decades ago, and it examines how America's laws and practices are rooted in racism. Advocates say the teaching helps us understand the systemic barriers that hold back students of color. Conservatives say critical race theory teaches kids to hate America. So Republicans in about a dozen states are pushing legislation that would limit or ban the teaching. Here's Governor Kevin Stitt of Oklahoma.
Verbatim, it reads, "No teacher shall require or make part of a course that one race or sex is inherently superior to another race or sex." To be sure, we must keep teaching history in all of its complexities and encourage honest and tough conversations about our past. Nothing in this bill prevents or discourages those conversations.
We're talking about that, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about critical race theory and how it's being taught in schools? Are you familiar with it? Do you think it's the right way to teach kids about structural racism in America's past or present? Or do you think that it makes people feel uncomfortable or guilty about being a certain race? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Aaliyah Wong is an enterprise reporter at USA Today who covers inequities in education. Aaliyah, thanks for coming back on Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
We should talk more about what critical race theory is and what it isn't and how it got started. Where do we begin?
Right. So critical race theory is actually kind of an obscure idea that developed in the 1970s by a group of legal scholars. The name critical race theory didn't actually get created until after that. But its proponents see it as a framework to examine how the legacy of racism continues to affect Black Americans and other people of color today, you know, and from who gets bank loans to who gets accepted into elite universities to how suspects are treated by police. But now we're seeing this opposition start to bubble up, and this opposition comes from people who see it as a way of teaching kids, you know, quote unquote, to hate their country or to promote what we now know as public school wokeness, this idea that we should be teaching this social justice in classroom.
What does it look like in the classroom then? Is there a lesson or is it content that's worked into the curricula? How do we apply it in our schools?
Right. So I think one of the most prominent or high profile examples of how it's being taught in schools is what's known as the 1619 Project. And that was a project developed by the New York Times. And it's gone on to influence a lot of curriculum around history. It's trying to reframe history, U.S. history in particular, about as a country that was founded in slavery and has continued to be influenced by that legacy of slavery. Other examples might be how teachers are, you know, teaching about things like the George Floyd killing and the trial of Derek Chauvin. It's about understanding that we have varied histories in this country, that we have varied experiences, and that people of color today are affected by those varied experiences.
So are people who are against having this talked about in our schools disagreeing that is fact, or are what part of it are they challenging?
So what they're challenging is the idea that by teaching that this country, you know, has this maybe a more insidious past, is actually teaching kids that white people, even white people today, would be oppressors or people who are accountable for the sins of our country's past. They might teach that, or what opponents would criticize is that they're teaching that kids today need to learn how to be, you know, accountable for those past sins, or how to be responsible for them, and that's where the controversy really bubbles up.
And help us understand again, why is it becoming such a flashpoint now?
So it largely traces back to President Donald Trump, or former President Donald Trump, who during his presidency issued an executive order that banned diversity trainings among federal workers. And that's when this idea of critical race theory, or the term critical race theory, started coming to the fore. And that's when it really started to crystallize. But it's not a new controversy by any means. I think for decades, if not centuries, there's been this cycle of schools teaching quote-unquote controversial subjects and that getting backlash. I think, you know, it has become a partisan issue, and that's why it has kind of risen to the forefront of people's, you know, political debates.
Aaliyah Wong is a reporter for USA Today. She covers inequities in education, and we're talking about bills moving through state legislatures meant to restrict teaching critical race theory in schools. You're part of this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. Tell us what's happening in your kids' classroom. Maybe you have seen, or maybe you are in a classroom and you teach critical race theory to your students. How do you apply it? If this is a new concept to you, what questions do you have about it? 800-642-1234 is a number to call. There's a line for you. You can also send us an email. That address is ideas@wpr.org. Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas recently said that colleges and universities are indoctrinating young people with un-American ideas, including critical race theory. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked to respond, and here is what she said on Thursday.
I don't think we believe that educating the youth and leaders of the future leaders of the country on systemic racism is indoctrination. That's actually responsible.
Aaliyah, has the Biden administration issued any guidance on how critical race theory should be taught in schools?
To my knowledge, it hasn't issued any formal guidance, but President Biden has been very clear that he thinks the ideas behind critical race theory play an important role in school. You know, really what critical race theory is talking about is that structural racism is a real and alive phenomenon that defines our lives and defines American society. And that, it, you know, it is something that ought to be acknowledged. It ought to be taught. It ought to be discussed in classrooms. So I think we are, especially in light of this recent spate of bills driven by Republican lawmakers, I think we are going to see a response on the part of Democrats in political leadership, saying that this is something that we ought to defend.
Let's talk more about those bills. What kind of legislation are you seeing introduced against critical race theory?
Right. So there have been about a dozen bills and counting. It's hard to keep track of them all because there have been so many, and a lot of them might not explicitly mention critical race theory. In fact, most of them do not. But they're all kind of getting at the same idea that they're, you know, some mention things like divisive concepts or ideas like you can't teach that one race is inherently superior or inferior to another, that you can't teach that people of a given race are accountable for the transgressions of their ancestors. But these have all been introduced, I would say, in the past few months. It's definitely a novel phenomenon. And some have, some of the bills have stalled in committee or just died altogether, but some are progressing full steam ahead, including one out of Idaho, one that really sticks out to me that actually was signed into law, 2 weeks ago. Yeah. So earlier this month, and that bill actually does mention critical race theory explicitly.
We've got Anthony in Mauston ready to talk with us this afternoon. Hi, Anthony.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, or my comment is really, those in favor of opposition to critical race theory, one of the ideas is that it, you know, we're asked or it teaches that we are asked to kind of pay for the sins, if you will, of our forebears. And the context, I think, that might have to help with that is this whole idea of reparations of the descendants of slaves in the past. And I'm kind of curious how the current environment we are in politically and this, all these different things, how that really can affect the perception of what this critical race theory has to teach.
Anthony, thanks for that question. And Aaliyah, what about reparations or that concept? How do you see critical race theory addressing that in schools?
Right. You know, I think that's such a parallel phenomenon, just seeing, you know, this movement for reparations. I think there is a lot of similarities in the sort of mission of critical race theory and the mission of reparations, right? It's to acknowledge that we do have this tainted past and that we should act on that and that we should teach about it to make society better, to you know, right the wrongs that happened historically. I don't think that, you know, in a classroom they would teach that we ought to do reparations. I think it might be included as a question, right? Like, should we engage in reparations? And I think that's an excellent example of how critical race theory can really work effectively in the classroom. If, say, you have a social studies class and you bring up the idea of reparations and you have a discussion circle where you ask kids whether reparations are the best or most effective way to right for those past wrongs.
So it's not necessarily prescriptive, but it might be part of the conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking about the push by Republicans in multiple state legislatures to ban critical race theory in schools. Aaliyah Wong is our guest. She's an enterprise reporter at USA Today who covers inequities in education. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about critical race theory and how it's showing up in the classrooms? What do you think Wisconsin should do when it comes to this sort of educational system? 800-642-1234, I should say educational concept, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. We are taking a look at critical race theory in schools. It's a concept from the 1970s and 80s that focuses on racism's role in American history and how it can still be seen and felt in laws today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our guest is Aaliyah Wong. She's an enterprise reporter at USA Today who covers education. And you can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you think of critical race theory and whether it has a place in U.S. schools. 800-642-1234. We have Tomas in Madison who wants to talk with us now. Hi, Tomas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question really tries to get at the whole idea of divisiveness and really in understanding the legitimacy of the feelings of that white people might have about being implicated in these kinds of things in history. My question is, how come critical race theory doesn't attempt, as far as I know, attempt to interrogate the economic backings or foundations of the oppressive practices of the past that were not only visited on people of color, but also on white people as well, and also attempted to pit those two people against each other.
Hey, Tomas, so does that mean you're looking to, you think that if we focus on the economic rather than just the social or racial aspect of it, that you think it would be more acceptable?
I think that addressing the central aspect of economics in those processes addresses the feelings of, the potential feelings of white people in that are potentially not well-versed in historical processes. That might feel guilty about it, that really goes to show it's not white
people versus people of color. It's economics.
Gotcha. Tomas, thank you so much for that, because Tomas is talking back to really how we started this conversation, Aaliyah, about the fact that we do have lawmakers saying this makes white people feel guilty about their race. And Tomas is saying, can we take an economic perspective? Does that lighten it a little bit? What do you think, Aaliyah?
I think that's an excellent point. And I think Tomas really gets at the root of why this is so controversial and why this causes so much distress on either side. I think, you know, critical race theory originally, like, you know, its founders or the scholars who really came about this idea would argue that they really tried to inject into this conversation an economic focus and an economic context. And I think, you know, when we talk about critical race theory, at least according to these scholars, it would be about, you know, who gets bank loans, who gets access to economic mobility and who doesn't. But I do think that's an excellent point that these conversations about critical race theory should be broadened, perhaps, to acknowledge the deeper and the more complex roots of inequality in this country today.
We're talking with Aaliyah Wong, who's a reporter for USA Today, and we're discussing how politics and education are clashing as conservative lawmakers work to restrain teaching critical race theory in schools. And we've got Peter from the Village of Summers on the line. Hey, Peter.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I am an educator, and I do teach history. And with my scholars, we discuss the importance of critical thinking. Now, when I hear critical race theory and there is the backlash against it from the right, what I sense is there is a deeper attempt at suppressing critical thinking. Critical thinking skills are essential for scholars to be able to understand different perspectives, especially about race and politics in this country. Now, for instance, studying the Civil War, in the South, a lot of people refer to it as the War of Northern Aggression. So with my students, I try to tell them that, look, you have to look at the perspectives of all the people involved and arrive at your own conclusion. Critical thinking skills. So when there is this war on critical race theory, I hear it as a war on critical thinking. Peter,
thank you for joining us to offer that perspective and share what you do. And Aaliyah, how do you respond to Peter when he's thinking about applying this in schools?
Right. I think Peter, again, makes such an excellent point. And it reminds me that critical is really the operative word in both of these concepts, right? We're talking about critical thinking, critical race theory. What it comes down to is really analysis, understanding how the past informs the present, and thinking about, you know, how we respond to the past in terms of our education, our conversations, our debates right now, our political debates. I think really if we take a step back and we think about what critical race theory is trying to do, at least what its founders wanted it to achieve, is that it was really trying to inject this idea that we should think critically about our country's past and its racist past to understand what society is doing now.
I'm stuck on this language that people who don't want critical race theory in schools are using, that it's teaching people to hate the country or that this is un-American. And I wonder if you can speak to that a little bit and help us understand either where that's coming from and whether that's true.
In my opinion, it's actually, I disagree with that. I think it's wholly American to think, like what Peter was saying, to think critically about the country's past and to understand how, you know, our history progressed and that trajectory and where it led us today. I think, you know, it might teach us that, hey, our country wasn't founded on the idealistic ideals that we might have thought it did, but is that un-American? I would argue that it's fully American, you know, as someone who comes from a place that didn't become a state until the 1950s, you know, being American to me from that state has really challenged me to think, okay, what does it mean to be American? And I think through this framework, I would understand America a lot better.
Do you expect more states to pick up legislation about critical race theory in schools in the coming, I guess, months or even years?
I do. You know, for better or worse, I think this has become a hot button issue. I think schools have become a lightning rod. They've become vehicles for larger political debates. And I think just because of the political climate right now, it's just inevitable that this is going to continue to become almost, in my opinion, a red herring. Something that people can attach to and debate about. And I think that's a sad reality. I think it's a distraction from the conversations we should be having about schools and civic education and history education.
So we'll focus on this as opposed to other aspects of education that affect our kids every day.
In my opinion, yes.
Yeah. Aaliyah, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you breaking it down for us and helping us understand what critical race theory is in the political climate.
Thank you so much for having me.
Aaliyah Wong is an enterprise reporter at USA Today who covers inequities in education. And we talked with her about the push by Republican state legislatures to ban critical race theory in schools, what it looks like, how teachers apply it, and what it isn't. Coming up, Northern Wisconsin's famed Telemark Lodge is being torn down. We'll learn about the history of the ski resort and what the plans are for its future. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. The Telemark Lodge in northern Wisconsin was once one of America's top destinations for cross-country skiers. But the resort closed in 2013, and this year, construction crews will take it down. While the building and its famous fireplace are going away, a new redevelopment plan would keep the site as a hub for winter sports. Chelsea Lewis is here to talk with us about it. She's a travel and entertainment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Chelsea, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We know the lodge is being torn down, but let's talk about how it came to be in the first place. This started in part with Tommy Wise, who sounds like he was seriously dedicated to his hometown. How'd he come up with the idea of starting the Telemark Lodge?
Yeah, Tony Wise was kind of the definition of like a hometown promoter. So he served in World War II, and at the end of his time, he discovered downhill skiing in the Bavarian Alps. And he thought, hey, maybe I can bring this back to Hayward and we can have, you know, a winter business up in Hayward. So in 1947, he opened Mount Telemark Ski Area. It was one of the first ski hills in the upper Midwest. A lot of people didn't even know about downhill skiing. It wasn't even really much of a sport yet in the U.S. So he kind of started it in the upper Midwest and grew it into a huge business up there.
And I should say, yeah, thank you so much, Tony Wise. The lodge itself is forever tied to skiing and the annual Birkebeiner ski race. How did that come to be the focus of this resort in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so in the 70s, Tony kind of thought he might have trouble competing with some of the bigger ski hills out west and even, you know, in the UP. Telemark was only 300 and some feet tall, so not exactly a mountain. So he decided to add some cross-country ski trails at Mount Telemark. And then in 1973, to kind of draw people to these new ski trails he put in, he hosted the first American Birkebeiner. So it was a version of a Norwegian race that kind of recreates this Norwegian event where some skiers known as Birkebeiners skied the Norwegian prince to safety during the civil war in Norway. So there were only, I think, maybe 50-some skiers that first year. But now, you know, almost 50 years later, the race draws 13,000 people every year from all over the world.
There have been a handful of owners and redevelopment plans in the past, but now the lodge is actually being demolished and there's a plan moving forward. What's the current vision for the Telemark site?
Yeah, so the lodge had kind of been the centerpiece of Telemark since the 70s, but in 84, Tony lost the property to bankruptcy and it kind of started to go downhill after that. The American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation, which is a nonprofit group that now manages the Birke race, they purchased the property in February, and the lodge was beyond saving. They just couldn't save it, and that's not really what they do anyway. What they do is put on events like the Birke and also other events like the Shawamigan Fat Tire Festival. So they decided to kind of make this like a hub for outdoor recreation. So they're going to rehab some of the old ski trails, which are also multi-purpose trails that people can hike. They're going to build kind of a new hub center for, you know, waxing your skis and pumping up your bike tires, because the Birke Trail, you can also mountain bike on it in the summer, and maybe add some other outdoor things too. They're talking about maybe putting an observation tower on the top of Telemark, maybe putting in like a community pool, and then letting other businesses come in and develop their own businesses there. So maybe putting in a tap room or a little coffee shop or a gear rental place. So it's kind of an exciting plan for the property that does tie in with what Tony had always hoped it would be, with this center for outdoor recreation, even though the lodge won't be there anymore.
Right. And it is coming down. But you also write that one Olympian said it was, quote, the finest ski hotel in the world and the only ski area where the lodge is bigger than the mountain. Describe what it looked like in its heyday.
Yeah, it was a hopping place. Its heyday was a little before my time, but most people who talk about it, they had performers like Frank Sinatra and Duke Ellington. Emeril Lagasse was a chef in one of the restaurants. It was always busy, of course, during the Birkebeiner, but even outside of that, there were a couple of pools, just a lot to do. So it was this big hopping resort. Like, Tony Wise wanted to do everything up right. He built this huge fireplace that was like 50 feet tall inside, so it kind of greeted you as you walked in. And the Birke Foundation is trying to save that. That's a lot of people know Telemark for this giant fireplace, and they're saving some of the stones and they're going to rebuild it in some kind of outdoor pavilion. So that's nice that they'll be keeping a part of that history.
Oh, how interesting. So although the lodge is going away, some of those touchstones will still exist in some form to help us remember.
Yeah, absolutely.
And is there a timeline on when this new vision could be a reality? When will we see things happen?
Yeah, the lodge is almost completely down. And then they're going to start with the ski trails, kind of rehabbing those. And they expect those to be open this coming winter. And then they'll start building those hub buildings, you know, the bathrooms and things like that. And those will probably be ready next year, 2022. And then they're hoping that they can make a bid for the Cross Country Skiing World Cup in 2024. So that's kind of their end date for when everything could kind of be devolved. But a lot of the ancillary development depends on other businesses. So that's kind of up in the air still.
All right. We'll pay attention. Chelsea, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chelsea Lewis is a travel and entertainment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she talked with us about the history of the Telemark Lodge and what happens in the future. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Joe Hartke looking back on one of his favorite stories in honor of the program's 10th anniversary on WPR.
I love the idea of radio sound as an Easter egg. It doesn't distract you from the joys of the entire Easter basket, but it does give you an especially memorable treat when you find it. I'm recording this next to the Rock River in the first full week of spring. The way the birds dance with the current here probably sounds like any other river to most of you, but if I heard this in a radio story, it takes me there. One example of that is the lead foot that hits the gas in Crystal Chan's story about her dad's shortcut from Oshkosh to Milwaukee. Who hasn't heard their dad's foot produce that sound? That's why it's my pick for my favorite Wisconsin Life piece.
My dad never asked for directions. He always knew the best way to get there, especially when he didn't. One spring day, we were preparing to go to Milwaukee to eat at our favorite Chinese restaurant and do some Chinese grocery shopping. We lived in Oshkosh, about an hour and a half north of there. As we packed up the car, Dad announced that we were going to take a new way to Milwaukee. We'll go north to Appleton, swing around Lake Winnebago, and catch Interstate 43 south. We can drive faster on the interstate, and we'll get to Milwaukee in no time. My mom, brother, and I stared at him. Dad, I said, Appleton is 30 miles north of here. Right, he said. It'll be a shortcut. Even my brother, who liked to defend my dad, said, usually the quickest way to go south is to go south. But no matter, Dad had announced the plan. North we went. And as we trekked our 30 miles to Appleton, an odd silence fell over us. Would it work? Would a wormhole open up and take us mysteriously to Milwaukee? We got to Appleton right on time, but there was no Interstate 43 there to slingshot us to Milwaukee. Instead, Dad had to turn east onto Highway 10, which wound its way through Brilliant, Reidsville, and Cato, very fine and slow-going towns, as we made our way to Lake Michigan. The clock in our car had never been so watched. Dad swore at the stoplights. Mom had the map on her lap, but he didn't consult her. Nothing else was needed. We were on the road for an hour when we finally got to the interstate, and the four of us breathed a collective sigh of relief. Kind of. According to the clock, we had precisely 30 minutes to go from Manitowoc to Milwaukee to tie our normal time. Usually, Dad drove 5 miles above the speed limit, but not that day. Dad was gripping the steering wheel with both hands. When the half hour was up, we were just south of Sheboygan. Nobody dared mention this. For in truth, not only was my dad's reputation on the line, but also his power to define reality. By the time we got to our restaurant, we were famished, but the food tasted funny and unsatisfying. I don't remember that trip delivering any great humility to my father. The thing that did change, though, was my blind faith in my father's assertions. And I made sure to learn how to read a map. Because you never know when it'll be your turn to find the quickest route.
Crystal Chan is a writer and storyteller who grew up in Oshkosh. That's where I went to college. It was a delight to sound design her words. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Joe Hartke, thinking of my dad and Leadfeet at the Rock River on a rainy day.
That was Wisconsin Life. Coming up, we talk with the president of the Stockbridge-Muncie community about her perspective on important issues that affect Wisconsin's indigenous peoples. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up at 6, the latest CDC guidelines have paved the way for millions of us to get back out there. But what if you're among those who are not ready for reentry? We've got all of that today on 1A Plus, starting at 6. Now, tribal leaders are laying out the challenges and opportunities facing American Indians in Wisconsin. Last week, we heard from President John Johnson Sr., who leads the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians in the State of the Tribes. Now let's hear from the president of the Stockbridge-Muncie community. Shannon Holsey gave the State of the Tribes address in 2017. She and I recorded this conversation last week. I asked her about how racial injustice affects the connections between Native and non-Native communities. Here's what she said.
oppression is all interconnected and it's not indicative of anything else. I know, like, we're right now facing, you know, this crisis of, you know, a country that's divided, and much of it is around the fact that it is intertwined to racism. You know, there are so many obstacles and indifference and discrimination to people with diverse backgrounds, and they face that daily. The fact that racism has been a part of America since its founding and really has been used as a manipulative tool to oppress and marginalize non-Caucasian people for centuries. And really understanding this reality requires a reminder of really how we've arrived at this point. You know, I don't really need to recite what the history of racial injustice in this country is, but we really do need to remind ourselves that all of these disparities exist, you know, and, you know, that sort of invisibility around, you know, some of those issues, you know, especially as it relates to Native communities. You know, for decades, we lacked representation information about Native people, which were damaging myths and stereotypes, like things with mascots. And in Wisconsin, the need for building out a more robust Act 31, you know, that's more led by speaking Native, the Native narrative to challenge those negative narratives and surround, you know, communities, making sure that there is accuracy and authentic portrayals of making sure Native communities are represented both in history and culture and in media. You know, I think right now, many of our children attend schools where information about Native Americans is either completely absent from the classroom, are relegated to brief mentions or negative information or inaccurate stereotypes. And this really results in an endearing and damaging narrative regarding Native people and tribal nations and their citizens. There are some exceptional efforts happening. I know that there was a very robust campaign around making sure that they brought through Act 31 accurate and culturally responsive and tribal specific contemporary content about Native Americans into mainstream educational systems. But, you know, a lot of things really need to be done. You know, some of the top research finds that invisibility is the modern form of bias against Native Americans. Many Americans are not clear about how many Native American people exist, kind of like, you know, sort of the adage, you know, my nation is the Stockbridge, Muncie, Band of Mohican Indians, sort of like the narrative of the last Mohicans, because it's in, you know, in mainstream society depicted in a movie, somehow people think that Native Americans don't exist, like the last of the Mohicans. But I assure you, we are not the last. You know, and those, that invisibility I talked about is one of the biggest barriers that Native people face in advocating not only for tribal sovereignty, equity, and social justice, but just being a larger part of the narrative, you know, and finding ways to show how that invisibility and stereotypes and false narratives underlie the stories being told right now about Native American people in the 21st century.
Shannon Holsey is president of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of the Mohican Nation. That tribal reservation is in central Wisconsin, and we're talking about issues, challenges, and opportunities facing American Indians in Wisconsin. You're listening to the Ideas Network. President Holsey, we know this pandemic is disproportionately affecting people of color. We know specifically that Black Americans are suffering more than white people as a group. What has the response to COVID-19 looked like in Indigenous communities?
When you speak of disproportionate, you know, Native American communities are extremely vulnerable. And I think COVID-19 and its response really brought to light the vulnerabilities that existed in Native communities. But it also spoke to the resiliency and the response to how we jumped to action and really were able to really enjoin our state partners like Governor Evers and his administration in terms of how we were going to battle this, from initial onset of it to making sure that we did everything possible to keep our communities safe, to having multiple shutdowns, even at our own expense, to robust campaigns around the need to vaccinate so that we can get to that herd immunity, so that we can start to return to some level of normalcy and safety. So we were all in it together, and it continues to be. And I'm very appreciative of that. But Native Americans, because of the disproportionate challenges, both health-wise and from an economic standard, I think dealt with it very, very diligently. But also, it wasn't something singular. It was something that collectively tribal nations worked collaboratively with our state legislatures and our governor to make sure that we got through this and continue to. But we really don't know the long-term effects it has on people. And quite honestly, losing one person's life to COVID-19, in my opinion, is too many.
What does economic recovery look like on the tribal level?
It's not, you know, as tribal nations, many of the tribal nations in the state of Wisconsin are some of the largest employers. So there is parity to the comparison of that of any other industry that was really adversely affected by COVID-19. You know, and in dealing with the pandemic, you're also dealing with closure, which equates to loss of revenues. And so, you know, what we're looking to is, you know, we're always looking to ways to collaborate. You know, I know Governor Evers has robustly been inclusive of his desire to look at economic recovery collectively, that he looked at our state in its totality. And that, along with previous to that, the CARES Act and now the American Jobs Plan and the American Rescue Plan, I think we all have to look, you know, to how we build back Wisconsin better in terms of we have to look at right now building back our antiquated infrastructures and bringing back of our jobs or new jobs as a result of the current market or the conditions of what's happening. And of course, you know, when you think of infrastructure, it's not just roads and bridges and those types of things, but it's also about making sure that we have, like, for example, an expansion of broadband. Anybody listening today will understand that a majority of Wisconsin's counties are rural, and many of us lack access to broadband. And many of us have found in the past year the innate need to have it, you know, and we need to really invest in Wisconsin's physical infrastructure and workforce and spark innovation, not only with like manufacturing, but also looking in ways to invest in our children and our families and helping them cover their basic expenses, because really so many of them struggle. And I know we all recognize we all need to do more. You know, you're not going to just immediately find economic recovery after a pandemic. You know, we need to work collectively as some of the largest employers along, you know, with our state partners in building a stronger economy that doesn't leave anybody behind. And, you know, we really have to make sure that there's inclusiveness of bringing everyone along, inclusive of gender, race, place of residence, urban, suburban, or rural, whatever that looks like.
What's happened with tourism for First Nations over the last year? Because tourism is an important piece of the economic puzzle.
It really is, as we rely on tourism and that mechanism of marketing, much like the Wisconsin State Tourism Department does. And it's been devastating, you know, because our operations have been reduced to 30%, you know, and of course, our communities have, for the most part, up until maybe a month or so ago, primarily closed with limited operations. So it has been extremely challenging. And so we've used this past year to really redevelop that element of tourism and redefine how we were going to do that through really robust marketing, making sure that in a safe way, there was outreach to many communities to see how there would be collaboration and effort to build back better, not only tribal nations, but the state of Wisconsin as well, because there's parity in all of it. When the state of Wisconsin does well, tribal nations do well as well.
What else do you want people across the state to understand? Because the things you're talking about are a lot of work.
But I'm inspired and I'm hopeful. I'm extremely hopeful, you know, because Native American people are resilient. And they have always been, and they always manage. They always, you know, at the heart of everything we do is our culture, our language, and our traditions. And that's what's our, you know, our North Star. It guides us in everything we do. So although challenging, we always find a way.
President Holsey, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Shannon Holsey. She's president of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of the Mohican Nation. We talked about some of the issues she sees facing Native American communities in Wisconsin and the opportunity she realizes for her culture and everyone in the state. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the high-stakes process of redrawing voting boundaries carries political implications and inevitably leads to lawsuits. Hear about the latest decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And we're talking about stuff, why we're attached to family heirlooms or prized possessions, and why sometimes we just don't really care. Share your story about your connection to your things tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then a conversation about the future of the GOP amid a shakeup in the U.S. House leadership. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is the Ideas Network, and you're listening to Central Time.